So it's obvious that California Farm Link has a really amazing website where you can find the leases that he talked about, just really practically. If you're farming without a lease, you're not, that's not wise. And you're also creating, you know, you're playing into a normative, you know, it's something like 60% of American farmland is leased, and a lot of that is on a handshake. And it's that kind of lack of commitment that leads to erosion of trust, of soil, and the care of stewardship. So let's formalize, you know, I'm wearing a jacket. We're growing up here. So we have the West Coast now. We have Kathy Roof coming from the East Coast. You're getting flanked. It's like in the country, you know, right wing and left wing meet. And next time we'll have more from the center, the next symposium, which will hopefully be in November on the East Coast. And of course, will also be podcasted for all you who will become devotees of this issue as we serve the land, I'm sure. Kathy, I'm going to let you introduce yourself.
Well, y'all are heroic for hanging out this long. And it's really an honor to be here all the way from Massachusetts and to celebrate beginning farmers and also to honor people who have been doing this work around beginning farmers and also land tenure and land reform and land access for several decades. Thinking about Susan, where are you? In particular, I cut my teeth on these land tenure issues working at the New England Small Farm Institute for 17 years, starting in 1987. Back then, Susan put together a small pamphlet called A New Lease on Farmland, and the Small Farm Institute was negotiating a long-term lease with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for about 400 acres of public land, and it took about the 17 years that I was there to negotiate that lease. And I learned a lot from that. I don't have a farming background. In fact, in terms of background, my parents and as children with their parents fled Nazi Germany and came here to the suburbs of New York. My father and his father set up their seed brokerage firm in the 82nd floor of the Empire State Building, and that's where my agricultural roots come from. Now, of course, the seed industry is very different. It is true that my father's firm, the people that he passed it on to, still exists as an independent seed brokerage, and one of their specialties is inorganic seeds. But of course, the rest of the seed industry is very vertically integrated and so on. So a lot of that time after the Small Farm Institute, actually, I've spent the last 10 years at a small nonprofit called Land for Good. We specialize in farmland access, tenure, and transfer, all the ways farmers can get onto, hold, and pass along farms and farmland. We focus on New England. It's our laboratory, but we do work nationally and have really enjoyed opportunities to work in venues such as these. So being last, I have been thinking all day and last night about how to not be redundant, but to take opportunities to reprise some of the themes that we've all heard today. So I'm going to talk fast and try to get through as much as I can so that we do maybe have a little time for conversation afterward. One of the things that I do want to stress, our mission is to get more farmers more securely on more land. And we do that in a combination of direct service, working directly with farmers, farmland owners, and exiting farm families, but also try to look from a systems perspective. I am a systems thinker, and as Joel was talking earlier today about farm systems, we also need to think about political systems, economic systems, cultural systems, movement systems. And so I'm going to take that perspective a lot because my point will be that to make any of these changes, we absolutely need to have everybody, everybody who's in this room, regardless of what role you play, every person at a civic level, on the community level, be involved. And I will be reprising that theme as I go along today. I know Raj Patel was not able to make it here, but I did want to put a nod to one of the comments that he made about that this is really about addressing the big structural problems like land use, transfer, ownership, and preservation. These are big structural problems. I also am really honored to be here to share and grow my own learning. This is a subject that I've obviously been working on for 27 years. 5 years ago, we held a national conference called Changing Lands, Changing Hands, and we also had USDA funding to put out a pretty extensive research report on farmland access, tenure, and succession, where we learned a whole lot about what is and isn't going on nationally. And I want to talk about or tease out some of the cultural norms and mythologies and tensions that have arisen, at least in my understanding. But I want to start with a quote that I came across quite a few years ago that I carry around with me. Equitable partition of land is the necessary basis of all self-sustaining agriculture. This partition of land and use of land may be in the form of ownership or in the form of the right to hold land for a specified time. The ownership may be of different degrees. The owner may have unlimited right to sell and to bequeath, or he may be bound by certain statutory restrictions. Likewise, the rental of land may be of different degrees and kinds, and in some cases, it may amount to practical ownership. These varying forms of land partition have arisen with the evolution of society. That was written by Liberty Hyde Bailey, who many of you know is the father of modern horticulture, and it was written in 1909. I carried around because on occasions like today, we do need to evolve, and that is in fact what we're trying to do. To me, the equitable partition of land really is about relationships, and that's what we're talking about now. It is between the owner and the user, who might be legally, in terms of title, the same, or they may be different. They are between public and private interests in property because, like it or not, that's where we're at right now. The entities or structures that we use to hold those relationships are really the framework, but we are talking about relationships. And we have to remember that the land is the third party in that relationship. So it's always a three-legged relationship. So what matters is how those relationships, values, and benefits and risks are played out. In my experience, farmers, like the rest of us, have different values about the nature of private property and property ownership and so on. And the questions really are, should farmers own the means of production? And we fall in different places on that continuum. An ag economist named Arnold Oltmans wrote a piece in 1988 in which he said, farmland cannot, will not, and should not pay for itself. So again, these questions are they're really fundamental questions about what it really means to relate to farmland, as was mentioned, not only as a productive asset, but now as a monetized appreciating asset as well. But land is also deeply emotive. And in the case of farming, it's where farmers live and have lived possibly for generations. So we have this mythology about real farmers own their land, and I've met so many young farmers who come in with that expectation and that desire. I'm not going to be a real farmer unless I own my land. Well, the truth is that almost half of U.S. farmers rent some or all of the land that they farm, and one-third of U.S. farmland is in fact rented. So it's also true historically. So I found this little factoid. In 1890, 75% of farmers under the age of 25 rented their land. And in 1999, 3% of U.S. farmland, only 3% of U.S. farmland was owned by farmers under the age of 35. 1999 was the last time that the USDA did the Agricultural Economics of Land Ownership Survey. It has not been done since then, so data around these particular land ownership and tenure pieces of information are not current, and I'm now involved in a national project to rekindle that, and USDA is making an effort to do a landowner survey in a slightly other format, but we're trying to look at collecting data about non-operator landowners, and I will talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. So the question is, are we promoting land ownership or not? It's a tension to me to say that, you know, the nature of private property ownership is really fraught, and on the other hand, lament that beginning farmers can't buy into private property ownership of farmland. So we really need to think about, you know, what is going to be the message. Somebody quoted Gary, I think, some of the early references to farming. I found one in Genesis. This goes back as far as I care to. Abraham bought land for 400 shekels of silver. So there is a long history of property ownership. There's also a long history of seeing land as the commons. So there is, again, this tension between what are the private interests, what are the legal obligations and rights under our current cultural and political system. Land tenure means to hold, isn't the same as land management. So we can't equate those, and neither is tenancy the same as serfdom. So we shouldn't equate those either. We've heard today reference several times to 400 million acres of land changing hands. That citation actually comes from the ag economist David Cole, who said up to 70% of private U.S. farm and ranch land will change hands in the next 20 years, and that was in 2002. So we don't really know what that trend curve is looking like now, nor do we know if it's changed in any way. And by the way, the corollary to that, which he also mentioned in the article from which that piece of factoid came, is that up to 3/4 of those who will get that land passed on will be women. Farm widows and other women landowners, and that's a particular demographic in addition to several others that we need to pay particular attention to. There's also been mention about the relationship of tenure and land stewardship. And while it's true that the data says that there are fewer NRCS-recognized conservation practices on rented land, the truth in other research says that it's much more complicated than that, that farmers on rented land will perform conservation practices depending on other things like their education, the nature of the farming community in which they are embedded, the kind of farming that they are practicing, the kind of crops that they're growing, the relationship to the landlord, the landlord's values, and so on. So as with a lot of what we're talking about, there is a lot of nuance. And the take home for me is that we need a lot more dialogue about what really these issues are and how we're going to address them at a pretty complex level. In terms of land conservation, we hear a lot about easements and removing development rights. There's been a study that shows that, yes, that helps with affordability somewhat, but it isn't a panacea. And there is a viewing screening, I should say, after this of the last crop, which talks about some of the problems with removing development rights if we don't pay attention to some of the policy twists that now we recognize have to go along with that. So the result of the work that I've been doing and the research and so on has shown me that three important things. One is that there's no overarching national policy on farmland access and tenure. That's really a place where we have to start and where we have to wind up. Also, that traditional methods of land access and transfer are not sufficient to address contemporary conditions. That's that sense of evolution. We really have to figure out some new methods and tools, which is what Severn and Agrarian Trust are really bringing to light in a really refreshing way. And we need new approaches to address some of these really fundamental questions. Who owns the farmland? What rights to land? Does it matter? And to whom? What should be the public discourse on farmland access, tenure, and transfer? How can interests and rights in land be most equitably distributed? What are the practical remedies, tools, and innovative solutions to the current challenges? And that's what our focus at Land for Good is about, and I sense that it's a lot of what we're striving for here together. How can farmers be supported in addressing these challenges throughout the business cycle? This isn't just about beginning farmers. As Joel pointed out, or maybe Gary, I'm losing my point of reference at this time of day. You can't, I think it was Joel, you saying you can't exit with that if you have barriers to entry? Well, you certainly can't enter if you have barriers to exit. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what we need to do with that population in addition. Who has a role to play, including those who are not farmers, not farming, and play a role in the community? It's also true, and I think about this a lot, that the norms and cultures around these issues vary from region to region. Farmland tenancy has a whole different valence in the South than it does in the Northeast and the Midwest. There's different kinds of farming, different kinds of farming relationships, how farms are transferred in the grain belt among family farm members is very different than how farms in New England are transferred if they are held by third or fourth generation people that no longer farm. What the definition of farming and farms is, what's sustainable, what's a viable farm? Is it realistic to imagine that a real farm is one by definition that can support two salaries? Doesn't happen often, at least in our neck of the woods, but yet those farms are really important and they really play a vital role in our ag economy. Okay, moving right along. Land for Good, in my decade there, has also developed principles, some of which overlap quite harmoniously with agrarian trust. The first one is opportunity. And when we unpack opportunity, we talk about availability. And for us in New England, with a very small land base and a very big population, available land is really, really important. There are folks in our neck of the woods and throughout the Northeast. New England, by the way, is six states: Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island. And we're small, and we count a lot on our exports. And no offense, but we would rather have more of our food come from New England than from California. So we are looking to build a more resilient and regionally focused food system. And in my other food systems work, that's what I work a lot on, is regional food systems. And so we need to make more land available. And we need to make it appropriate to the farmers' goals and needs, as well as the natural resources that are required to make that enterprise successful. It needs to be affordable. And affordable doesn't necessarily mean cheap. Affordable means within reach and economically viable for that farmer. And this is, again, a bigger food system issue, because if farmers were making more money, land would be more affordable for them, right? So it's a bigger kind of a question. It needs to be secure, and it needs to be appropriately secure for the farmer's need. Now, many beginning farmers, if they don't think that they can afford to buy land, are really fearful of having an annual lease and their rental agreement. There are many reasons to be concerned about that. On the other hand, there are many reasons to favor a short-term lease to begin with. It's good to experiment. It gives you flexibility and so on. So it's appropriate security. It also has to be findable. And this is one of the biggest barriers where California FarmLink and other linking programs have really come into the fray. Linking programs are really challenged, and if I have some time, I'll talk a little bit about that later. I've studied them since I helped start New England LandLink back in 1994. But findable, if a beginning farmer can't locate that piece of land and test whether it's appropriate and make that transaction, these transactions aren't going to happen. So there's a big disconnect. There's no MLS. And in many regions, realtors don't specialize enough and are not that interested and are not really key players. Okay, so in addition to opportunity, there's the equitable division of rights, risks, responsibilities, and rewards. And again, this is this higher elevation discussion about really how we partition those between the operator, the owner, the land, and the community, the common interest. There also needs to be accountability, which agrarian trust talked about, and resource stewardship, both in the protection of the land and the nature of its use. One parenthesis in there is that we've talked a lot about food, food security, food sovereignty, and so on. I'm not convinced that we should only be talking about food. In many farms, diverse farms, in many regions, we grow more than food, or we grow other than food. There's feed, there's fiber, there's fuel, there's horticulture. And we should be crediting those farms with making our land and homes more beautiful, clothing us, and so on. So there's this, again, tension between, are we talking about only food, or are we talking about a variety of farm products? And I'm not going to answer that here. I just elevate that as a, you know, as sort of pretty provocative. So New England is our laboratory. It's not the breadbasket of the world, but it's our breadbasket. And so we learn a lot. We're ahead of the rest of the country in some ways because of the development pressures that we've been forced to contend with for decades. Our farms are smaller. And a really important issue that's only come up sort of marginally is farmer and farm worker housing. You may be able to afford a few acres of land, but if you can't afford a house to live there, you're not home yet. So that's a really big issue. And looking at some of the community land trust models and some of the other mechanisms that can tie house affordability with land affordability as well. So what we've learned is that it takes a system, and you can't just look at one constituency such as new farmers. How am I doing for time?
You got about 15 minutes.
Okay. So I'm going to skip over some of the demographic interesting things about new farmers. Just to mention that for new farmers, the reality is that tenure is a path. So you're not hooked into any one choice. It will evolve over time, and we shouldn't only be thinking about new farmers. Beginning farmers being defined by USDA is 10 years or less farming. If you are just starting your first 3 years, your land tenure needs are going to be very different than when you're re-strategizing and rethinking things in years 4 through 7 and getting yourself established in years 7 through 10. Then if you're an established farmer and you're scaling up, moving out or whatever, you have land issues as well. So we don't want to pit beginning farmers against established farmers in that way. So let's talk about exiting farmers. I think that this work is as much about helping our senior farmers find a meaningful legacy and a secure exit from farming as it is about farming opportunity. So this is where, in a systems view, we're taking a look at the whole farming system from a human perspective as well, and looking at the farm business cycle, if you will. Not long ago, there was a convening here on the West Coast of veteran or pioneer organic farmers, and Steve and Gloria Decatur were there, and it was reported about in the New York Times. Maybe some of you saw that. And it commented, the author of the article commented, that the biggest topic of conversation was succession, that these farmers were really struggling to figure out what they were going to do with their farms, and not only with their farms, but with all of the embedded knowledge that they had and how to carry that on. Land is most threatened at these times of transition, and so we have to understand that exit and entry are tied intimately together. In one study, 2/3 of retiring Iowa farmers did not have identified successors. This is a huge challenge. My colleague in Iowa points out that he's surveyed older farmers, and he asked them if they were if they wanted their kids to come into farming, and they said, no, farming's so terrible. I never left the farm in 50 years, and I really don't wish it on them. It's so horrible. And then later in the survey, if you had it to do all over again, would you choose farming? This was to the senior farmer. You know, 90% of them said, yeah, you know. So a little ambivalence, but the point is that many younger generation people from the farm are leaving the farm, and at the same time, as somebody pointed out earlier on, we've got all these farmers not coming from farm families that want to get onto farms. So there's a potential win-win in there that we haven't quite connected the dots. Most farmers do not have succession plans. In fact, one survey showed that up to 90% of farmers do not have a succession plan or know how to develop one. We were part of a consortium that gave a whole bunch of farm succession and estate planning workshops. These one-off farmers came and they listened to these lawyers and, you know, LLCs and trusts and da-da-da, and their heads were spinning, their eyes were rolling, and we did a post-workshop survey, and none of them knew what to do next. So the biggest issue is not that there, you know, isn't like the tools out there, it's to help farmers get the process going and help them sustain it. So what we do is we call it coaching, and we really stick with those farm families. Another really important distinction is when I get together, and Reggie will know this as well, with farm succession folks, we talk about the hard issues being the soft issues. It's not whether you should do an LLC or a LC3 or whatever it is. It's what's your vision? What is it that you want to do? What are the challenges? What does your life look like when you're not farming anymore? What does retirement look like to you? How do you get along with your son-in-law or daughter-in-law? These are the things that are really going to shape the transition planning that has to happen. There isn't enough technical assistance, which Reggie also pointed out. We need more lawyers. Susie, call out to you. There's a lawyer named Susie in the room. Financial planners, tax consultants, land use planners, realtors, long-term healthcare planners. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out, but it takes a team. We wrote a guide to farm succession planning using the team approach. We've done cross-disciplinary team training. Because it does take a team, there's no one individual, no lawyer, no tax planner, no farm business consultant can answer all the questions and hold the hand of that farm family as they do the transition planning, which can take 6 months to 2 years. The actual transition plan can take up to 10 years. It is a process. One of the biggest issues is that there's no clear definition of retirement. These days, in general, I mean, I'm thinking about what does that mean to retire for me? But certainly for farmers, they'll mean it in a different way. Some farmers say, yeah, I'm going to retire next year, but they're still getting on the tractor. And they may even still be holding the checkbook. Others say, no, I'll never retire. And in fact, that's what they say. And, you know, they're on the tractor until they fall off. I didn't make that one up. Somebody else has said it. One of the things to recognize in farm transition planning is that it involves the transfer of income, assets, and management. And oftentimes, it's the management piece that's the least understood, regarded, and the most fraught. A legal friend of mine who does a lot of succession planning talks about this farmer who comes in and says, you know, I really want to do some succession planning, but my son is just not ready to take on management. I just don't feel comfortable with him. He just doesn't know enough yet to take it on. Well, the old man's 96 and the son is 74. It always gets a laugh, so I can tell if people are listening, but it's also true. This transfer of management absolutely has to happen. They're called a farmer's boy, and it really is a phenomenon. And there have been international studies that show in terms of transfer of management which things tend to be transferred, and it's, you know, which day you buy the feed is, you know, sort of first, and the very last is to transfer the checkbook, of course, right? So by that time, the son, who's maybe in his 50s if things are going well, still hasn't managed the checkbook. The old man falls off the tractor, and Junior doesn't really have the management capacity to run that farm. It's a serious issue, right? So we need to start early. This is one thing that I'm really going to be working on in my organization, and I'm hoping that others will join with me, is to start this whole notion of succession planning early on in the process. Start with farmers in their 50s, at the peak of the business cycle. There's a study that was done in Holland, but I'm sure it applies here as well, is that farmers make business decisions, like whether they should buy another toy, at the peak of the business cycle, depending on how they perceive the succession outcome to be. So that's where we need to start the process, with those kinds of business decisions, and realistically, what are farmers going to do about retirement? We don't have a retirement policy here that incentivizes farmers, and they're so proud of not putting, paying taxes or putting money into Social Security, they'll reinvest it in another toy. So we need to think about that. We need to engage farmers a lot earlier on. How am I doing? Okay. What? Okay. So I'm going to skip over some things. Farmers on the land, don't own the land. Shared ownership. I think that's really what we're talking about a lot in these new models. I used to talk about, you know, different tenure models, and a lawyer, corrected me, and he said, well, there's only two. You can own it or not own it. So I said, okay, you can own it or not own it. I don't think that that's as simple anymore. These shared ownership models may be really, in fact, what we're talking about or where we need to be going more and more, because there are roles for different people who aren't going to be the farmers who can really support the farming. A colleague of mine at Farm Credit, we were talking about this issue, because I've really been struggling with, you know, what does it mean to own or not own and build equity. One of the principles up here is that farmers should really build equity in the land. And I asked him what he thought about that. He said, you know, when I first started out, he's been in Farm Credit for 40 years or whatever, he said he thought that was really true. He didn't think so much anymore. He said it's important for farmers to build equity. It doesn't have to be in the land. Interesting, right? It's important to think about your finances, to be a smart business person. But again, it raises up the question about, you know, what are your beliefs about the placement of equity and what you want to, how you relate to property. He also did a spreadsheet that showed for a farmer's net return to family living on land that he or she owns that does not have the development rights removed, another column with a net return to family living when the farm is owned with development rights removed, and then net return to family living on a farm that they were renting. The net return to family living on the rented farm was 6 times greater than the net return on the market value land. Now, the bottom line also says, well, if you own that land, at least you have equity in that land versus if you've rented it. But if you're collecting that much more return, you can put that money elsewhere. And certainly in the beginning, you can invest in other capital improvements in your farm business and eventually possibly buy land if that's what you want to do. It just means thinking a little bit more broadly about what the options are. Non-farming landowners are a huge untapped resource and constituency. Our research showed, based on these statistics that may be a little old, but I think they're still the same, that 88% of farm landlords are not farmers. So who are all these people? 88% of farm landlords are not farmers. They're families, they're farm widows. They could be retired farmers, but they're also increasingly removed from they're called absentee landlords, right? But some of them are residents, so we call them non-farming landowners. USDA calls them non-operator landowners. They are increasingly removed by geography and also by generation from that property. So they could be living in Chicago and they own land in Kansas. But they also could be living right there and owning land that could be farmed or is being farmed. So again, the question is, what is the relationship between the landlord and the land user? What happens to the asset? What happens to the equity income that is generated from that rental agreement? Is it taken out of the community? Is that okay or not? We also have a broader range of non-farming landowners as well. Institutions, educational institutions, religious institutions. I've worked with some religious institutions that own land. Their convent is diminishing. They have strong social values about the land stewardship and opportunity, and they've created some pretty amazing relationships to get farmers onto their land. All kinds of organizations, conservation organizations, recreation organizations, and so on. And these begin to tap into this notion of shared ownership or ownership of the commons. And certainly Schumacher Center and Equity Trust have been at the forefront of many of these kinds of relationships, and the Life Power Farm and various other ones, Peacework Organic Farm, really show us that there are a range of relationships that are possible and successful. Terre de Lien as well. There's also a whole category of public land, municipal land, county land, state land. When I worked at the Small Farm Institute, as I mentioned, that was public land that we were negotiating a long-term lease on. And there are some states that have public rental programs, and then you get into legal things about the difference between leases and licenses and so on. But there are increasingly, the food movement is really an opportunity for us because people are starting to connect the dots. And if we can do that, if we say that food security depends on farmer security and farmer security depends on land security, people who have not thought about land in that way are going to start saying, oh, Yeah, that really does make sense. And there is town open space here that is agriculturally capable. And there is state land in every state. Hasn't necessarily been inventoried, hasn't necessarily been thought about in that way. Massachusetts does have a state land rental program, as do some of the other states in New England. So a whole category of investors, which I could go on for a while. It's a different subject. Suffice to say that it's, as Anuradha said yesterday, it's scary. I think that there are also promising partnerships with people who have assets, who are willing to partner in a slow money, values-based way. We did some research on values-based farmland investment. Very gray, the numbers, you know, it's not really sure how those are going to pencil out, what's in it for the land, what's in it for the farmer, how are those models really going to work. But there, I think there is some promise as well as some real concern there as well. Okay, Severin asked me to talk about what are the opportunities for partnerships. Well, I think we've talked a lot today about what those opportunities are. We've had convenings that are regional, that are statewide, that involve food policy councils, that involve regional planning commissions, local zoning, you know, tons of partnerships, lawyers, all those professional advisors, and so on. It is part of the policy landscape more now. Certainly when I started this 25 or even 10 years ago, nobody was talking about land access, and nobody was talking about beginning farmers. So things really have changed. Let's see. We do need a better nuance on the division of rights and responsibilities, and that's been written about on the global scale as well as what we need to think about more locally. I'm wrapping up. Service partnerships. It does take a team. Just like it takes a system, it takes a team. And we do need to do training, capacity building. We need to bring these new players in, and we need to do much more work with non-farming landowners. There's very little support for those landowners. There's one or two. Drake Agricultural Law Center has a really nice website for landowners to encourage landowners to understand what's in a good lease, to encourage landowners to foster farmland stewardship and conservation practices, to encourage landowners to take risks and do share leasing instead of cash rent, to encourage landowners to think about longer-term leases, rolling leases, lease-to-own, gradual transfers, and so on. Farm linking services, we need to do a much better, have a much more robust understanding about what is actually involved in listing properties, linking those services, and actually doing the match, and all the technical assistance that's needed to bring those parties together for a successful consummation. There's nothing more dangerous, and I've seen this in my experience, that you sort of happily bring, oh, they want a dairy, they have a dairy, you do this, and it falls apart, and both parties are really disenchanted. So we need to be able to do that right, and so we need to have people who can really support both the landowner and the farmer to give them enough information, support, options, so that when they do come together to make that transaction, their chances of success are much higher. So, easements also, we can get into that, it's a whole other conversation. I would say, you know, if you are a member of a community, you can work with your planning and zoning and master planning and municipal partners to see how farm friendly your town is. Are there rewards for making land available? There are many policy options. We wrote a report that had many of them. I don't know, how many more minutes are you gonna give me? I'm talking as fast as I can.
Take a few, finish up on a good note.
A good note. There are policy options. I won't take much more time because I know it's really hard for you guys to pay attention. There are several states that have income tax credits to landowners who lease to beginning farmers. We can also think about incentives such as capital gains or transfer tax rewards to landowners who sell to new and beginning farmers. We can think about policy incentives to encourage gradual transfer or to encourage farmers to invest in some kind of retirement plan. We can encourage states to make their public land more available. We can look at the next generation of easements and foster tweaks to the Federal Farm and Ranch Land Protection Program that will allow coupling of affordable housing with affordable land, that will look at the possibility to subdivide some of these larger properties that aren't viable as large properties. We can support the guarantee program for land contracts and really help those kinds of transactions come up. So there are some policy options for those of you who tend in the wonk direction. Severin also helped found the National Young Farmers Coalition that is led now by Lindsay Lusher Shute out of the Hudson Valley. And she said, the issue of land access is at the very root of our work. It's certainly at the root of my work and with Land for Good, and that's why it's so heartening to be here with you all this afternoon. Thank you.